of your life, guided you through so many sacraments. And we were together for 2 years before you shoved me into that hotel wall. It was 2 more years before you punched me, and another year after that before you punched me again. The violence came on so gradually, and then so fast. To Father Ian, to everyone but you and me, my complaints came out of nowhere. In the end, we compromised. Father Ian would counsel you on the proper ways to handle an argument, and I would pray to become a better wife. A honk comes from behind me, 2 friendly rapid-fire beeps. I look up to find a pretty blonde in my rearview mirror. She waves, diamonds winking on her wrist, and I try to remember what Martina called them, these wealthy women from the northern suburbs. Betty somethings. I gesture for this one to go around, but she doesn't move, and the road is too narrow for me to turn around. With a sigh, I put the car in drive. The 2-lane road slices through a manicured lawn clotted with oak leaf hydrangeas and boxwood sculpted into perfect circles. Before I can find a place to turn around, it dumps me into a parking garage, 5+ stories of stacked concrete. I swing the Buick into a visitor's space, finally shaking off the blonde on my tail. She motors past, rounding the corner to the next level. The holy hush. That's what I've since learned it's called, this brushing of allegations like mine under the altar rug. Though I suppose I should give Father Ian a little credit. He lived up to his end of the bargain and talked to you. But whatever he said only made things worse. You came home looking for a fight, one that ended with a concussion and a week-long ringing in my ears. That Sunday, Father Ian pressed the communion wafer through my split lips like nothing had ever happened. As soon as I turned away, I spit the thing into my hand. I realize that not every church operates this way, that ignorant and willfully blind priests like Father Ian are, for the most part, a dying breed. I once read an article about an abused woman who claimed church was the only thing that kept her going. The 1 hour each week she allowed herself a glimmer of hope. And yet I stare out my windshield at this one, and I feel nothing but dread. Martina all but guaranteed they would hire me on the spot. She said she told them that I clean like she does, powering through 6 toilets in the time it takes others to scrub one, even though she's never seen me work so much as a sponge. I have no idea why she has taken up the role of my protector, but I'm not exactly in a position to turn her down. I do a mental count of the bills strapped to my stomach. After Jorge and groceries, it's a whole lot lighter than it was just yesterday. It would take me days to find another job, which means, church or not, I can't afford to walk away from this one. I brace myself and climb out of the car. The garage stairwell dumps me out at a side entrance, and I step into a hallway that smells like pine and incense. I follow it past a long line of double doors, then stop at an open one, gawking into a cavernous space 3 stories high. Rows and rows of plush crimson seats, thousands of them, are arranged in sections on a gentle slope around a podium hung with stage lights and 2 giant LED screens. And what's that? An orchestra pit? Voices come from somewhere behind me, and I continue down the hallway, following the signs to the administrative offices. Colored light trickles down from stained glass windows high above my head, painting patterns across a freshly vacuumed carpet. I can't imagine why they need another person on their cleaning staff. So far, everything I've seen here has been spotless. The executive offices are bright and spacious, and as far as I can tell, span the entire length of the church. There's a reception area straight ahead, with hallways dotted with doors on either side. A woman sits behind the receptionist's desk, one I recognize. Prim white blouse, understated pearls, diamonds at her wrist, blonde hair teased into a helmet atop her head. Up close, she's not half as pretty as she was in my rearview mirror. She greets me like she's never seen me before.
Welcome to the Church of Christ's 12 Apostles. What brings you in today?
I'm here to see Father Andrews.
It's Reverend,
she corrects, turning to her computer. She punches a few buttons on the keyboard with a baby pink nail.
Do you have an appointment with the Reverend?
Yes, at 10. I arrange my face into a careful neutral. My name is Beth Murphy. She tells me the Reverend had a minor emergency in the music room and asked me to meet him there, then rattles off a series of convoluted directions for what is basically a trek to the basement. I thank her, then head in search of the stairwell. A few minutes later, I step into a full-on recording studio, modern and airy, furnished with sleek black chairs and leather couches arranged in clusters around a stage. Multiple rehearsal rooms, each with their own mixing panel, are lined up along the wall, across from a soundproof recording booth. Behind its smoky glass, a spongy microphone hovers like a spaceship from the ceiling.
Hello?
A thump, followed by a muffled curse, drifts up from somewhere behind me. I turn, and that's when I see them. Two stovepipes of dark denim ending in orange Nikes poking up from under one of the mixing panels. He wriggles himself out and heaves to a stand, holding out a hand.
Erwin Andrews,
he says, smiling behind his clipped white beard.
And you must be Beth.
I shake his hand, swallowing a flutter of nerves. It's been years since I've been on a job interview, especially one for which I am so monumentally unqualified. I know how to scrub a toilet, yes, but what if he asks about prior experience? What if he asks for references?
Why don't we sit?
The Reverend is fit despite his age, popping off the ground with surprising speed and agility. He leads me with long, nimble strides to a matching pair of couches to the right of the stage. He's a runner, judging by his shoes and his build. He points me to the couch, then plucks a chair from the stage and swings it around, placing it so we're almost knee to knee. Not too close, but not far away either. Relaxed and informal.
I know what you're thinking, he says, clasping his hands. Why would the pastor of a place this size want to interview every potential employee? Why not let someone else do it? The office manager, maybe, or the head of the cleaning crew.
It's almost word for word what I said to Martina last night when she told me she'd set up the interview. She didn't know the answer either.
Martina says that you interview everybody.
I tell my nerves to shut up, but they don't listen, and neither does my body. Sweaty hands, hammering heart, the works. I clear my throat, struggling to rein myself in.
I do, Beth, and I'll tell you why. Because we are a community here at CCTA, and as its leader, it is my responsibility to keep people from harm. Everyone who walks through that door needs to know that they are sheltered, regardless of where they came from or what brought them here. That is the promise I have made, to provide a secure, positive, healthy environment where everyone, from the worshipers to the volunteers to the janitors, know that they are safe.
In other words, he needs to ensure I'm not a criminal. He says it without rancor, but still, Reverend Andrews is the godlier version of Miss Sally. I wouldn't want to cross him either. I nod, plastering my most law-abiding look on my face.
That makes total sense.
Good. Excellent.
He slaps his thighs.
Now, I assume you know how to operate a mop, so we can skip the boring parts of this interview and get right to the part where I ask if you can sing.
I blink, frowning. I'm sorry, what? He waves an arm at the setup along the edge of the stage, guitars and microphone stands, and a drum set worthy of Charlie Watts.
Music is an essential part of worship at CCTA, an essential part of our culture. God has blessed me with parishioners who have the voices of angels to make up for others who are, how shall I say this, not put on this earth to carry a tune. Sometimes the Lord works in mysterious ways, and other times he is painfully obvious.
He sticks a finger in his ear, jiggles it around.
What I want to know is, which one are you?
I fall in the second category, unfortunately. Another lie. I can sing, and I can read music, too. But admitting to either would mean getting shoved onto this stage, or worse, the one upstairs, in a cathedral that must seat thousands. The spotlight can feel too hot, too bright, even when you're not trying to hide. No way I'm letting them shine it on me.
What about an instrument? Do you play anything?
Piano. Or I used to, until you mangled my left pinky. No, I shake my head. Sorry. The Reverend looks mildly disappointed.
What about a beat? Can you carry one of those?
He taps his foot, snaps his fingers in a slow, rhythmic cadence. I can't help but smile. I can do that.
Excellent. Then you can play the tambourine. We always have room for more tambourine players.
And here it comes. The invitation to attend Sunday services. Reverend Andrews wants to save my soul, and he wants me to play the tambourine while he does it. I picture me in a swinging, swaying crowd, joyous faces tipped to the heavens, while he holds his healing hands above us all. There will be no tambourine playing in my future. No church service either. He swings an ankle over a knee, leaning back in the chair.
Do you have a favorite team?
I dip my chin, raise my eyebrows. Team?
You know, sports. Football, baseball, basketball. And don't be looking at me like it's a crazy question. More than half the hardcore Atlanta United fans I know are female. 15-9 our first season. You like soccer?
I'm not really much of a sports fan. For the next 20 minutes, the Reverend wanders topics like a drunken bumblebee, bobbing from bloom to bloom. We talk about movies. I haven't seen one in ages. Books. I will read anything but horror. Whether or not I thought the TV show did The Handmaid's Tale justice. Yes, absolutely. He asks me my favorite color. What am I, 12? Fine. Yellow. And what do I think about when I'm alone in my car? How not to get pulled over. We touch on favorite foods. Mine, French fries. His, pizza. And this place I absolutely must visit. The Beltline, a walkable, bikeable trail that connects dozens of in-town neighborhoods. Because I haven't lived until I've had the truffle fries at Biltong Bar. Ask for extra mayonnaise. Our banter is more suited to a bar, or maybe a Match.com chat group. I don't know what this conversation is, but it's definitely not an interview.
Well, Beth,
he says, once the topics are exhausted.
Sounds like you'd fit in just fine around here.
I blink in surprise. That's it? Interview over?
You seem surprised.
Not to be rude, but don't you want to ask me about my experience? Question me about cleaning skills or ask me about, I don't know, my relationship with God or something?
Your relationship with God is just that, yours. It's no business of mine unless you make it that way. And Martina already vouched for your cleaning skills. Everything I've seen and heard from you so far lives up to what she told me.
I don't ask what she told him, because I'm not sure I could keep a straight face when he rattled off what must have been a string of lies and fabrications. I've known Martina all of 2 days, and the longest conversation we've had was on that first night, when I bumped into her in the kitchen. She knows nothing about me other than what she's seen, and I've made sure she hasn't seen much. And yet she's told the Reverend all about me. Yet another favor. Yet another reason for me to question her motivations. What does that girl want from me?
There's some paperwork that needs filling out upstairs, he says, standing. The official application so we can process your paycheck, and another one so the USCIS doesn't come banging on my door with a big fat fine. I assume Martina told you to bring some identification. Trotting out my new ID feels as precarious as walking the ledge of a cliff, but I pat my bag with a nod. Not a problem.
Then welcome to Church of Christ's 12 Apostles, Beth.
He sticks out a hand, and we shake, mine pressed between his two warm palms.
We're glad to have you join our ranks.
Thank you, Reverend. Really, this means a lot to me. To my absolute horror, my eyes grow hot, the tears welling so quickly it's impossible to blink them away. I choke on a small but audible sob. I can't even tell you how much. The Reverend takes me in with a kind expression.
Are you all right, child?
I wipe my cheeks with my fingers, but new tears tumble down before I can mop the old ones away. Thank you, but I'm fine, or I will be. I don't even know why I'm crying. I force up a throaty laugh. I promise it won't be a regular occurrence. I hate to cry. For the past 7 years, my tears have been slapped, backhanded, punched, yanked, kicked, squeezed, and one time burned out of me. Tears are a sign of weakness, followed always by punishment. Only losers cry. But this man doesn't taunt me for them, and he doesn't look away.
If you ever want to talk about anything,
he says warmly, patiently,
you should know that I'm a good listener. Ask anyone. They'll tell you, I take care of my flock.
I murmur another round of thanks, for the only thing I can focus on is getting out of here and into the restroom across the hall, where I can splash the splotches from my face and reapply the mascara I'm almost certainly crying down my cheeks. He lets me go, and I'm almost to the door when he stops me.
Oh, and Beth.
His lips curve into a gentle smile, and I can see how it could melt a church full of people hanging on his every word.
What I said before about taking care of my flock, that includes you. Whatever brought you here, whatever burdens you think you're carrying, you can lay them down. You're one of us now.
45 minutes later, I'm back in the church basement, where Martina is busy attaching a battery-powered vacuum to my back.
Did he ask you to be in the band?
Martina says, holding up the straps for my arms. The two of us stand in the center of a room that does triple duty as a kitchen, break room, and cleaning supply closet. An old television is pushed against a wall in front of mismatched sectionals, and to its right, a workstation with multiple sinks for rinsing buckets and rags. Two walls are lined with floor-to-ceiling shelves that belong in a grocery store cleaning aisle, or maybe an episode of Extreme Couponing. Sponges and mops, neatly stacked buckets, every cleaning product imaginable. My uniform came from the giant Tupperware containers on the bottom shelf, khaki pants and a white t-shirt with the church logo and God Works Here, embroidered in looping navy letters across the front. The get-up looks ridiculous over the pleather Mary Janes I wore with my interview dress, but I didn't think to bring sneakers. He asked me if I could sing or play an instrument, yeah. I shove one arm through the loop, then another, and she settles the thing on my shoulders. For a piece of machinery, it's pretty light.
I knew he would. He asks everybody to be in the band.
She reaches around me from behind, snaking the harness around my waist, and I stiffen. Her fingers brush over the money belt, but don't linger. She smells like bleach and peppermint gum.
What else did you talk about?
I don't know. Lots of stuff. TV shows and books and truffle fries. It was the weirdest job interview ever. She grabs me by an arm, turns me around to face her.
Did he tell you the joke?
I shake my head and she grins.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Jesus.
Jesus who?
Jesus Christ, open the door.
I laugh, not because the joke is funny, but at the idea it originated from a man of God. What happened to not taking the Lord's name in vain? Father Ian would lose his shit. Martina hands me the vacuum hose, shows me how to work the on and off button on the side. I flip it on, and the nozzle suctions itself to the carpet. Good gear is half the work, I say, before I can stop myself. One of your favorite one-liners. I flip the switch, both on the machine and in my mind, and turn to Martina. I still don't understand. He didn't ask me one single question that was relevant to the actual job. No personal questions either, other than silly things like whether I put on both socks before my shoes or do one foot at a time. The whole time I'm just sitting there waiting for the bomb to drop.
The Reverend says the past only defines us if we let it. He says you can let it hold you back, or you can be set free.
Martina takes on that church-like expression I've come to know so well, a combination of holier-than-thou satisfaction and wondrous drink-the-Kool-Aid joy. And this is what Father Ian could never explain to me about organized religion. You are invited into the flock because you are damaged goods, and then you are expected to transform into a righteous follower, to throw out your doubts with your sins and just believe. In the end, after all that happened while going to that church, I couldn't do it. I lean in and lower my voice, even though we're the only two in the room. He also said they needed my ID so they wouldn't get fined by the USCIS. That's the Citizenship and Immigration Services, Martina. Her eyes narrow.
What would you know about the USCIS?
The accusation in her words revives my doubt of her Grady baby story. And what about that Spanish-tinged accent she tries to bury under a southern drawl? If Martina were born here, in a hospital in the state of Georgia, like she said she was, what would she know about the USCIS? I know what the letters stand for, I say, but I'm also assuming they have these things called computers, which will light up like a Vegas slot machine at my fake ID and social security numbers. She chews her lip. They won't, she mumbles, but I catch a flash of panic in her eyes.
Jorge recycles the numbers. He only uses ones that are real. Ours won't get flagged.
Whatever uncertainty I had is wiped away just like that. Martina is a Jorge customer, too. A fugitive, posing under a name she wasn't born with. Maybe I'm right to guard the cash strapped to my waist. Suddenly this room feels too crowded, too hot. I need to get away from here. Away from her. I gesture to the machine strapped to my back.
So, where do you want me to start with this thing?
Upstairs, she says, stepping to the shelves for a vacuum of her own.
We start at the top and work our way down. Like a team.
But I'm not blind, and I'm no fool. I caught her glance at my waistline. Whatever Martina is after here, I'm pretty sure it's not teamwork.
Jeffrey. When I wake up on Saturday morning, I shoot off a text to my boss explaining why I've been MIA for the past 2 days, then pull the pillow over my head. It smells like Sabine, like that sweet spicy stuff and the overpriced bottles on our shower shelf, and I shove it to the floor. I stare at the ceiling and tell myself to get up, but my limbs feel hulking and heavy, like those sandbags that pile everywhere when the National Weather Service issues a flood warning. I barely slept, thanks to the constant hum of the search boats in the waters behind my house. They're out there now, and I waver between worry and fury. What kind of idiot do they think I am? Like I would be stupid enough to dump my wife's body in my own backyard. Like I would ever be that reckless. I watch Dateline. I know to not pollute my own property with evidence. They could give me a little credit and search farther downstream. Then again, I haven't given them much reason not to suspect me. Not after my miserable performance in Detective Duran's office. My non-answers about my whereabouts Wednesday afternoon. I'd blame it on being rattled. The knowledge he'd been checking up on me, unsettling me enough to stumble over my answers. But the truth is, it was Ingrid. If she hadn't been sitting right there, waiting the air in the room with her huffed sighs and cheap perfume, then I might have told them the truth. The detective is a guy. He might have understood, but not Ingrid. No fucking way I was telling her. It was like when you get a Trivial Pursuit question you know the answer to, that panicked, white-hot moment before the answer rolls off your tongue. I took some deep breaths, blew them all out, but the answer didn't come. And now Detective Durand and his Keystone cops are determined to pin Sabine's disappearance on me, instead of finding the person actually responsible. Because it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, though they say they're looking for Sabine, what they're really searching for is her body. By the time I wake again, it's well past noon, and the noise of the boats is muffled by a low rumble coming from my front yard. Reporters have descended on the house like a flock of starving vultures, pecking at me through the glass. It's not enough that they ruin my front lawn with their vans. They hurl questions at the house whenever I so much as walk by a window. Yesterday, I pulled all the shades, but I can still feel their presence the way you feel a tornado bearing down outside, ominous and deadly. I know from their questions that the police and their merry band of volunteers have searched everywhere there is to search. Pine Bluff's fields and patchy woods, the town's parks and hills and riverbanks. No bits of fabric to show for their efforts. No long strands of brown hair found stuck in a tree. If Sabine is anywhere close by, if she's on Pine Bluff soil or in her muddy waters, chances are good that she's dead. Anger and grief, remorse and regret, the emotions churn in my empty stomach. There are a million things I want to say to Sabine, and now it looks like I'll never get the chance. The light in the room has shifted, the afternoon sun finally climbing high enough to hit the bedroom windows. I stare up at the ceiling, listening to the camera crews on my front lawn, and a wave of anxiety drags me from bed. I need to run, to pump my legs until my heart wants to explode and my chest burns with the lack of oxygen, to abuse my body until I forget these past few days ever happened. I pull on running shorts and a t-shirt and grab my phone from the nightstand. 127 messages. I scroll through the texts and emails, variations of the same message. OMG, so shocking. Anything I can do to help? Thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers. I'm pleased that the tide has turned, but I'm not naive enough to know that it won't. Ingrid is probably out there right now, alerting the world of the 2-hour hole in my day. It won't be long until she tells the press, too. I peel the shade from an upstairs window and take a peek outside. Reporters stand in clumps on my front lawn, drinking coffee and shooting the shit like my life is a fucking happy hour. The Arkansas sun beats down on their heads and reflects off the pavement behind them like water. Good. Hope they're roasting out there. Downstairs in the kitchen, I inspect the contents of the fridge, searching for breakfast. Leftover pizza, a half-empty pack of eggs, some fuzzy cheese, and a gallon of spoiled milk. Sabine didn't spend any of the time I was out of town at the grocery store. And why would she? My trip to Florida was like a birthday, anniversary, and Christmas rolled into one. 4 whole days of unmonitored time with her lover. They probably spent every free second together, especially since his wife moved out. No nagging spouses at home, asking, "What's for dinner?" I grabbed the eggs and slammed the refrigerator door. If I'm going to hide out here all weekend, I need to go to the store. Tension creeps into my shoulders at the thought of backing my car through the throng of reporters. Maybe I should talk to a lawyer. Get him to chase them off with the threat of a lawsuit. And while I've got him, ask what the implications might be now that Detective Durand knows about the unaccounted-for patch of my Wednesday. Then again, what is the detective going to do? Arrest me? He can't do that without evidence. Without a body. A 2-hour window doesn't make me a murderer. I'm cracking the last of the eggs into a pan when the doorbell rings, and I check the window by the garage. Somehow, my brother Derek has managed to plow his Camaro past the reporters, And now he's out there, preening for their cameras. Shit. I drop the blinds and return to the eggs, watching them pop and hiss in the pan. To open or not to open, that is the question. The doorbell rings again. 4 quick punches, followed by a fist pounding on the door. Come on, Jeffrey, I know you're in there. It's me, Derek. Let me in. I poke at the eggs with the fork. Letting him in would mean uncorking a spiky, barbed ball of age-old grievances and passive-aggressive rage. Derek resents me for my job, my house, my wife. Ha! Joke's on me. My car and my clothes, the inch-and-a-half height I have on him, even though he's the older brother. I resent him for the way he tortured me at school, bullying me with taunts and ridicule, and once a wedgie delivered in front of the entire football team. We are like Mentos and Coke. Put us in a container together, and it's not long before we explode. I hear him clomping up the steps to the back door. He finds the spare key Sabine hid under the flower pot and slides it in the lock. There's a whoosh of sliding glass, a roar of rushing water, and a few seconds later, he's standing in my kitchen. Didn't you hear me? He says, tossing the key onto the kitchen counter. I've been banging on your door. My brother is his usual slouchy self. Faded and ripped t-shirt, cut-off jeans, flip-flops. Derek is the high school star quarterback who never made it off the bench in college. He flunked out sophomore year, and his life has been shit ever since. I heard you. What are you doing here? Not the nicest greeting, but considering our relationship, not the worst one I could give him either. I figured you could use the moral support, but I can just as soon go back home. He hikes a thumb over his shoulder, but it's all for show. His soles are super glued to the hardwood. So I guess your wife finally had enough of you, huh? You're a real dick, you know that, right? Jesus, chill out, will you? I'm only kidding. He moves farther into the room, taking a look around, kind of like that detective did in my foyer. Like he's cataloging all the things he can't afford and silently judging me for them. He whips off his shades and hangs them from the collar of his shirt. Seriously, man, what can I do? Nothing. I turn back to the stove. Though I really appreciate you coming over to gloat and all, but you can go now. Derek moves closer, his flip-flops slapping against his crusty heels. I'm just trying to be helpful. Jeez, why do you always have to be such a dickwad? I don't know. I guess it runs in the family. I thought maybe we could drive around and look for her or something. I toss the fork into the pan and flip off the gas. The eggs are burned, the edges brown and papery. I dump them, pan and all, into the sink. What, do you think she's just hanging out on a street corner or something, waiting for a ride? No, but maybe she drove that fancy car of hers into a ditch. Maybe she had a flat tire. Don't you watch the news, Derek? They found her car at the Super One. It was abandoned. His eyes go wide, and he leans a hip against the granite. Holy shit, bro. That sounds serious. What do the cops think happened? That somebody took her? I yank open the refrigerator, pull out the pizza box from the night Sabine went missing. The crust is hard as dried dirt, the cheese an orange rubbery blob. I pick up a piece and bite into it, and it tastes as disgusting as it looks. I'm pretty sure they think that I took her, I say around the pizza. You? Have they lost their minds? Why would they think you took her? I stuff my mouth with another bite in lieu of answering. Answering would mean telling him about the backhand, her affair with the doctor, the missing 2 hours of my day, none of which I plan to share with my brother. Ever. Derek likes to pocket my shortcomings and failures, store them in his basement brain like dormant Molotov cocktails. Weeks or months or years from now, when the rest of the world and I have moved on, he'll toss one into a conversation just to see the fireworks. What about Ingrid? He helps himself to a slice of pizza, which he shoves in the microwave for a minute and pulls a beer from the fridge. What about her? Come on, man, stop being so difficult. What does she think happened? I sigh, sinking onto a counter stool. That heavy sandbag feeling is back, along with a knife point throbbing behind my eyes. I'm pretty sure she thinks the same thing. He pops open the beer and tosses the top on the counter. Well, okay. Who cares what old hag thinks? Cops are the ones you need to convince. I roll my eyes, toss the bottle top and the rest of my pizza slice into the trash. You're a motherfucking genius, Derek. You really are. Convince the cops I didn't do it. Why did I think of that? I'm serious, Jay. I know a guy who works for Century 21, and he's always talking about the crazies who wander into his open houses. Mostly people come for the free snacks or to take a dump in the powder room. But just last month, some asset pulled out a gun. Took my friend's wallet, his watch, the keys to his car. Sabine's hot. It's not unimaginable somebody saw her and got the wrong idea. I know, I've been telling her that for ages. The microwave dings, and he reaches in for the pizza, then snatches his hand back with a hiss. He rips a paper towel from the roll and tries again. And what about those gangs over on the east side? All those break-ins on Cherry Street aren't for nothing, you know. Those little shits are taking over the city. It's only a matter of time before they move their territory up this way. Maybe it was them. Maybe, I say. Because for once, my brother is not wrong. The gangs are taking over the city. And thanks to the soaring unemployment, the poverty, the crappy schools graduating illiterate halfwits without a single marketable skill, there are fewer and fewer people here to stop. What used to be a hard-working American metropolis now has the dubious honor of being one of the most dangerous cities in America, second only to Detroit. The smart folks have all moved away. Maybe I should join him. He folds the slice in half. An orange oil spurts onto his hand, dripping down his fingers and onto the floor. I'm just saying there are a million people it could have been. Seems to me the cops are being lazy, focusing only on you. Don't let yourself be an easy target. Show them it's not always the husband. He shoves half the pizza in his mouth in one giant bite. A long strand of melted cheese dangles from his chin like a worm. But for the first time in, well, ever, I don't gripe at him for the mess. My idiot dickhead brother has a point. I have let myself be the easy target. I pluck my phone from the countertop, pull up a number I once knew by heart. After two rings, a familiar voice hits my ear. It's about time, she says. I've only been leaving you messages all over town. Amanda Shepherd steps through my front door, looking just like she did in high school. Blonde, thin, a complicated sort of pretty. Big lashes and acrylic nails and long, heat-curled hair. Her face is caked under a layer of makeup I've never seen her without, not even the summer before senior year, when our entire class spent every day bobbing in blow-up tubes on the river. All the other girls had shiny cheeks pink from the sun, but Amanda's makeup was like a mask, flawless and impenetrable. She pulls me into a perfumed hug. Oh, Jeffrey, you poor, poor thing. Her voice echoes in my foyer, loud and consoling in a way that makes it feel exactly the opposite. It's her television voice, the one she's cultivated for her show, Mandy in the Morning, a local daily featuring all things mundane and ridiculous. I extricate myself and give her a tight-lipped smile. How are you doing? How are you holding up? Are you eating at all? I think of the eggs in the sink, the pizza I shoved out the door along with my brother, right before she got here. A little. If I'd known, I would have made you a casserole. She waves a manicured hand through the air and laughs. Oh, who am I kidding? We both know I can't cook. I would have ordered you some Chinese takeout or something. Anyway, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. And please, I say, gesturing toward the living room, make yourself at home. In the 60 minutes it took her to get over here, I cleaned up the place. I dusted and fluffed all the pillows, and I exchanged my running shorts for a pair of khaki slacks and a navy polo over loafers. Nothing too fancy. I don't want her to think I'm trying too hard. She steps into the room and gasps, making a beeline to the wall of windows. She stops just beyond the desk, standing before a sheet of glass lit up by the sun. It turns her hair iridescent and makes the fabric of her dress float like a wispy cloud around her body, a cloud that is more than a little see-through. Well, well, well. Amanda Shepherd is wearing a lacy red thong. You're so close to the river, she says without turning. Like the house is floating on top of it or something. I know. The view is stunning. Yes, it is. She presses a hand into the glass, and the sun turns her skin to fire. Amanda is conventionally beautiful, but up to now, I've never found her all that attractive. Too processed, too high maintenance. But standing here in my cheating wife's house, I'm beginning to see another side of Amanda, the side that would make a spectacular revenge fuck. I clear my throat. The view is what sold us on the house. Turns every window into a piece of artwork. Did you know the river changes colors, depending on the weather and time of day? I didn't know that until I got to look at it every day. She smiles over her shoulder. Well, Jeffrey Hardison, you sensitive old dog, you. Next thing I know, you'll be reading me poetry. At the south end of the river, a black search boat motors upstream, and multiple people lean over the sides, staring into the water. Do you mind if we get started? I say, pointing Amanda to the couch before she sees the boat. When we're done here, I need to get over to the police station and see if there's any update about Sabine. I just came from there, actually. She wrinkles her nose, stepping away from the window. They won't tell me anything other than that Sabine's car showed up at the Super One, which, in all honesty, it tells me nothing. Who are the suspects? What are the clues? The people of Pine Bluff deserve to know the truth, Jeffrey. I agree. She sinks onto one of the twin three-seaters, and I choose the one opposite her. The search boat is stopped in the middle of the river, the flashlights all trained to one spot. I watch as a man in full diving gear slips over the side. I really wish you'd have let me bring the cameras, Amanda says, dragging a voice recorder from her bag. I shake my head. There's an orchid in the air between us, and I shove it to the opposite end of the table. I already told you I can't say or do anything that might get in the way of the police investigation. She freezes, one arm stretched halfway to the coffee table. So this is off the record, then? She straightens, holds up the recorder. Can I even use this thing? I lean back in my chair and pretend to consider it. Amanda loses patience after only a second or two. You called me here for a reason, Jeffrey. Stop playing around and tell me what it is. Fine. I called you here because I want you to help me set the record straight. The thing is, I've seen this movie, and I know how it ends. With the husband serving 20 to life. Only the guilty ones, she says it teasingly, playfully, letting it hang with obvious implication. Come on, Amanda. We've known each other for what? 15? 20 years? She purses her glossed lips. I won't tell if you don't. Behind her crossed legs, a stealthy thumb presses down on the record button. I pretend that I don't notice. Long enough for you to know what I am and what I'm not capable of. I may be a dick at times, but I am not the kind of guy who makes his estranged wife go missing. I'm not a murderer. She tisks at the word estranged. Shelley McAdams is a friend of mine. Let's just say she's not taking it well. The doctor's wife. At least I'm not the only sucker. Yeah, well, no offense to Shelley, but she's one of the reasons I called you here. The police seem to be assuming this was a crime of passion. But I'm not the only one with a motive. How do we know Shelley didn't, I don't know, seek out her own revenge? Because Shelley is in Chicago interviewing divorce attorneys. Amanda flashes a sorry, but I'm on her side smile. Don't be surprised if she gets full custody of the kids. Okay, so other people then. You know the statistics on crime in this town. Sabine has money. She's gorgeous. And she's often alone in some empty house. There are plenty of sickos out there. How do we know it wasn't one of them? I'm sure the police are looking into it. No, they're not. That's the whole point. As far as I can tell, the only person the police are sniffing around is me. Then why don't you look into a camera and tell the world you're innocent? When I don't respond, she adds, if you're nervous, if you need some media coaching, I can help you get some. It's not that hard. I'm not nervous. I just think what I have to say would mean so much more coming from someone who's not me. What do you have to say? I have information about my wife. information that, coming from me, would sound suspicious. Coming from you, however, it would be news. Amanda straightens in importance at the last word, just like I knew she would. Amanda longs to be seen as a real journalist. She spends a lot of time online, promoting the newsworthiness of her show on social media, defending it from people who dismiss it as fluff. Calling her a journalist is like handing her a Pulitzer. It validates her. How about this? I swing my ankle over a knee, sinking deeper into the couch. You put that recorder of yours onto the table, and I'll talk into it and tell you what I know. When we're done, if you like what I have to say and want me to say it all over again into a camera, we can talk about that too. By now, Amanda is like a dog with a bone. I've given her one with just enough meat that there's no way she will let it loose. But she's always been a bit of a drama queen, and she takes her time pretending to decide. Arms crossed, eyes narrowed, glossed lip working between her teeth. I settle in and indulge her theater. After a few seconds, she places the recorder on the table. Showtime. I walk her through what I know, that Sabine was there in the Super One lot before she disappeared, that she left without her car and her burner phone, but with her iPhone, which the police have not been able to locate, that I was the one to sound the alarm a few short hours after she was expected home, that I've barely slept since. So what, then? Do you think someone took her? I shrug. It's possible, I guess. But there was no sign of struggle near her car, no blood on the ground or tire marks. If she got into someone's car, I'm guessing it was someone she knew. Then again, I think it's much more possible she... I wince, looking down at the sisal carpet. Amanda scoots forward on the couch, leaning in. You think it's more possible she what? I heave a full-body sigh. I feel like I'm betraying Sabine by even bringing this up. But I also think if she were here, she'd understand. The thing is, and you're the first person I've ever told this to, so please forgive me if I stumble over my words. But a little over 2 years ago, Sabine was going through a rough patch. Her mother has Alzheimer's, and she stopped recognizing Sabine. Not every time, but that first time was pretty devastating. On top of that, we heard the baby Sabine was carrying, the one we'd spent a lot of money trying to conceive, didn't have a heartbeat. All that goes to say, things were really, really shitty. Amanda makes a sound of sympathy, but she waits for me to continue. After she lost that baby, it's like she, I don't know, went to a place I couldn't follow. She stopped eating. She stayed in bed for days at a time. She was self-medicating with alcohol and leftover painkillers and whatever else she could get her hands on before I flushed it all down the toilet. Then one day, she was fine. She got up, got dressed, and went back to work like nothing had happened. She sold 3 houses that week and listed 2 more. I remember thinking, that's how good a broker my wife is. That she can end 3 comatose weeks with deals totaling more than $1 million. How did she do it? Amanda asks. I have no idea. It could have been a fluke. Deals that she had been working on before the miscarriage that suddenly came through. I don't know. But the point is, I finally relaxed. I thought things were better. That she was better. And I stopped hovering so much. I pause. Counting in my head to 3. I shouldn't have stopped hovering. Amanda's forehead crumples between perfectly sculpted brows. I don't understand. What does all this have to do with what happened to Sabine? With wherever she is? Maybe nothing. Maybe everything. I fill my lungs with breath. Blow it slowly out. The vapid Amanda holds hers. What I'm trying to say is, Sabine has done this before. Amanda's eyes go wide. You're not suggesting. I nod. 2 years ago in November, the day after Thanksgiving, Sabine got on a bus and disappeared.
Beth. Early Monday morning, Martina shows up at my door, fresh from the shower.
Good morning. You look pretty. Let's carpool.
Her face is bare, rosy cheeks and scrubbed skin, a fringe of dark lashes that doesn't need mascara. Two French braids snake around each ear and leave twin wet marks on her "God Works Here" t-shirt. The total effect is easy, youthful, adorable. I smile and reach for my keys.
Good idea. I'll drive. But I've already got mine.
She holds her car keys up, jingles them in the air beside her face.
I'm a real backseat driver,
I say, nudging her out of the way so I can step into the hall. You don't want me in your passenger seat, I promise. I'll only make you crazy. And besides, I like to drive. What I really like is to stay in control. No way I'm strapping myself into somebody else's car and letting them steer me Lord knows where, not with every penny I own strapped to my middle. I'm not about to relinquish my cash or my shiny new command on life that easily. At least behind the wheel of my own car, I am the one in charge. As long as things are on my terms, I wouldn't mind the company. Martina opens her mouth to argue, then becomes distracted by a door opening at the far end of the hall. Tom, the red-faced, sweaty guy who lives in the room across from mine, steps out of the bathroom in a puff of steam. He's soaking from his 3-minute session under the shower, water streaming in rivulets down his short, square body, and onto the hallway runner. His hair, usually wrapped into a complicated comb-over that's not fooling anyone, hangs in thin strands onto his bare shoulders.
Good morning, ladies, he says. You two are looking awfully spiffy today. Matching outfits. I like it.
Better than his outfit, which is a tiny slip of ancient terry cloth slung low around his potbelly. It flaps open when he walks, providing intermittent views of something I'm trying hard not to notice. Martina makes a face.
Put some clothes on, Tom.
Gotta dry off first.
I thought that's what the towel was for.
I make a sound in the back of my throat. Towel is a generous term.
Nope. Towels for modesty.
He stops at his door, giving us his hairy back while he works in his key.
My body parts function best when they air dry. You two have a good day now.
He steps inside and shuts the door. Martina turns to me with a concerned frown.
Is that true? Am I supposed to be letting my parts air dry?
I laugh and head for the stairs. Come on, I don't want to be late. We run into Miss Sally in the hallway below, her hair wound around fat curlers the same hot pink as her silk robe, a floral kimono wrapped loosely around her body. It hangs open between her breasts, two jiggly mounds of flesh right at eye level. What is it with half-naked people in this place?
Well, don't you two look like the double mint twins, she says, taking us in from head to toe. I see our Martina got you a job, huh?
I glance at Martina, flashing her a smile. She did, for which I am forever grateful. Martina grins and bumps me with a shoulder.
I hear good things about that place. A friend of mine goes there every Sunday, sits front and center, right in front of the big cross. He's been trying to get me to go, but I keep telling him not to bother.
Miss Sally's gaze dips to my chest and the text written across my shirt.
Unlike your souls, I'm pretty sure mine is doomed.
Don't be fooled, I say, laughing. I'm going to need more than a t-shirt to save my soul. Miss Sally laughs like we're in on the same joke, even though all those things I used to believe about my inherent decency are no longer true. I've lied, I've cheated, and before this thing is through, I will have done much worse. Some might say that makes me just as bad as you, but I don't believe that. This is nothing like the times you held me down and spit in my face, punched me in the stomach so hard I stopped breathing, held my neck and tried to make me swallow a whole bottle of Ambien.
I don't want to do these things.
You told me after every instance.
It must be you. You are the one who brings this out in me. I wouldn't be like this if you were a different woman.
What I'm doing is self-defense. For me, this is survival. We say our goodbyes to Miss Sally and head out the door. Sometime during the night, clouds rolled in, bringing with them a humidity that makes it feel like we're walking through water. The air's so thick it has a weight to it. The inside of the Buick is even worse. The dampness has seeped through the cracks in the windows and turned the upholstery clammy. We sink onto it, and it belches up a bouquet of scents I've not noticed before. None of them pleasant. Cigarettes and body odor, and something sour and rotten, like spoiled milk. I start the engine and hit the buttons for the windows to air out the stink.
Sweet ride,
Martina says, sliding her hand up and down the armrest, and I wonder if she's messing with me. Either way, it doesn't make me any more eager to ride in her car. I pull up the map app on my phone, and Martina waves it away, directing me out of the neighborhood. She chatters as we wind our way through the streets that are already crowded with the morning rush, people like us going to work and school. And I wonder how we look to them. Normal, probably. Like one of them. Once we're hurtling toward the highway, a route I recognize, she settles back into her seat, kicking off her sneakers and swinging her feet up onto the dash. Her toenails are painted a bright metallic blue.
So, what's the deal with you anyway?
The question is broad enough that it could refer to any number of things. I glance over, trying to judge which one. But Martina's profile doesn't give anything away. She points at the light and says,
green.
I look both ways, then tentatively press on the gas.
What's the deal with me how? Well, you insist on driving, even though, and no offense, you're not very good at it. You have nightmares almost every night, screaming nightmares. And yes, everybody at Morgan House hears you. They're all talking about it. And any time anyone asks you anything even remotely personal, you mumble something vague and change the subject. You won't even tell me where you're from.
I'm from Oklahoma. It's a lie, but it matches the car's plates, so what the hell?
Where in Oklahoma?
A town nobody's ever heard of. That, at least, is the truth. Except when it comes to crime rates, Pine Bluff isn't exactly on anyone's radar. A town I'm trying really hard to forget, I add, trying to shut down this line of questioning. Martina shrugs.
We're all running from something, but if we're going to be friends, you've got to at least give me something. That's how this works, you know? You tell me something about yourself, and I tell you something about me.
She's right, of course. That is how friendship works. Though I'm not sure friendship is the goal here, for either of us. It certainly wasn't Martina's goal when she pocketed Jorge's kickback without a word to me about it. And yet, God, what would it be like to make a friend in this place, in this city? Someone to laugh and share jokes with. A ride or die like the ones I used to have before you drove a wedge into every single one of my friendships. I like Martina. And the truth is, I could really use a friend.
I told you where I was from,
she reminds me.
I even told you about my crack whore mom, and I never tell anybody about her. The least you can do is share a truth about yourself.
Truth. The word strikes me as funny, and I bite down on a laugh, a big belly guffaw. What truth? So far, neither one of us has been willing to take that first leap and share something completely honest. And I'm sure as hell not going to be the first. This new life, for as long as it lasts, depends on me telling no one the details of my past. I take a left up the ramp to I-75, which looks like a parking lot. A bumper-to-bumper sea of red brake lights. Exhaust shimmers in the air, undulating waves rising up like heat.
I slow to a stop behind a souped-up truck and twist on my seat to face her.
You told me you were born at Grady Hospital, but in an accent that sounds like it came from Mexico. You basically admitted you were Jorge's client, too. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure I believe half the stuff that comes out of your mouth. What does an American-born citizen need from a guy like Jorge, other than kickbacks? She frowns.
What does that mean, kickback?
Like when he paid you a commission for sending me to him, that's a kickback. And speaking of kickbacks, a real friend would have told me about it, or maybe even shared it. Friends don't use other friends to try to make a buck.
What are you talking about? I didn't earn a commission from Jorge. Who told you I did?
The truck in front of us rolls a few feet forward, and so do I, nudging the nose into traffic.
Jorge told me. He said he'd pay $50 for anyone I sent him.
What?
$50?
Her cheeks flush, and her eyes squeeze into a squint.
Per person?
I nod.
Oh, no.
She shakes her head, hiking up on a hip.
Oh, hell no.
Spouting a steady stream of angry staccato Spanish, she wriggles her phone from her back pocket and stabs at the screen with a finger. I pick up a few choice words, puta, cojones, mierda, while the speaker burps a rhythmic tone. A few seconds later, Jorge answers with a curt,
yeah.
She switches to English, her words high and clipped.
Jorge, Martina, what's this I hear about a commission?
His voice bursts from the phone speaker.
Who tell you that?
Beth, you offered her one when I've sent you, what, 10 people at least? Don't tell me all those checks must have gotten lost in the mail, is that right?
Jorge's pause is 2 seconds too long.
Commission is new, just started.
Uh-huh.
Martina looks at me, rolls her eyes. The first wave of guilt rolls through me, nibbling its way across my stomach.
This is some serious bullshit, Jorge. You owe me like $300.
Okay. I pay you next time.
No, you listen to me. There won't be a next time, not until I get that money you owe me. Do you understand what I'm telling you? Not one more person until you pay.
There's another long pause, then a sigh.
Fine.
Fine,
Martina barks back, then disconnects the call. She drops it on her lap with an angry squeal.
I can't believe he did that to me. What a snake. What a dirty, disgusting snake.
Guilt flares, heating me from the inside out. If anyone's a snake here, it's me. I wrap both hands around the wheel and wince. I just assumed he offered you the same deal he did with me, Martina. I never even considered. I shake my head, glancing over. I feel like such a shit. She brushes away my apology with a wave of her hand.
You're not the shit. Jorge is the shit. He's the one I'm mad at, not you.
Still, I'm really, really sorry. At my apology, her anger vanishes as quickly as it appeared. She turns to me and her smile is big and real.
See? This is what friends do. We apologize, we forgive, and then we do better the next time. If you have a problem, you come to me and we'll talk about it, okay?
I nod. Okay.
Great. So, now it's my turn.
She inhales, long and deep through her nose, then blows it out in one giant huff.
Okay, fine. I don't like the way you look at me sometimes.
How do I look at you?
Like you think I'm about to tackle you. Like you think I'm after however much is in that thing hanging at your waist. But I wouldn't do that to you.
She points a finger at my face, wags it in the air between us.
You and I, we are friends, and I wouldn't hurt a friend that way, Beth. I wouldn't.
She says it just like that, like it's decided, like it's a fact. She is to be trusted. We are to be friends. She holds me in her brown stare for a few more seconds, and I can't deny her message tugs at something inside me. The thing is, I like Martina. Even though I haven't believed much of what she's told me so far, I think this might be the nugget of truth I was searching for. I was wrong about her dealings with Jorge. Maybe I was wrong to be suspicious of her, too. I believe you, I say. And God help me, I mean it. I believe Martina when she says she wouldn't take my money. I just pray it's not a mistake. The car behind me leans on the horn, and I press the gas and slide forward, smiling. The truth is, it's nice to have a friend. Unexpected, but nice. Martina tells me she's 28 as we work our way through the nave of the church later that morning, stacking Bibles and hymnals in the cubbies between the seats, dropping in bulletins for the evening service. Her family has either died or moved away, all except for a younger half-brother, Carlos, a boy half her age about to start high school at Grady, which I gather is a different place than the hospital where she claims to have been born. The two share a father, a deadbeat drifter who last she heard was playing drums and dives up and down the West Coast. Carlos's mother is kind of a bitch, but she doesn't drink or forget to buy groceries, and in Martina's mind, that more than makes up for any snarky remarks. Martina talks and talks, a constant stream of words to plug the silence, and I don't interrupt. As long as she's the one talking, I don't have to do anything but listen. As we're nearing the last row of a section, I step on something hard and lumpy. I reach down, pick up a baby's pacifier. It's grubby and cracked, the pink face missing its ring. Should I throw this thing away? I say, holding it up. Martina takes it from my fingers, tosses it into an empty box. We never throw anything away here, ever. We take it to Lost and Found. Not that anybody will ever come looking for an old piece of plastic, but it's not up to us. You never know what you'll find. Phones, keys, gum wrappers, and Lord knows what else. Once, I found a diamond earring. A real one, too. How do you know it was real? Have you seen the people who come in this place? She snorts. It was definitely real. I think of Charlene, the blonde receptionist I met my first day here, with her silky dress and sparkly jewelry, and I don't argue. Anyway, wait till you see this place tomorrow morning, after the Reverend packs the house here tonight. There are 8,000 seats in this place, 8,000 bodies, and at least half of them drop crap out of their pockets for us to pick up. I reach inside a box for a fresh stack of bulletins. This place is nothing like the church I used to go to. As soon as I say the words, I wish I could snatch them back. Not that Martina seems to notice my accidental sharing. She picks up a piece of trash from the floor, tosses it into the box, and moves farther down the line. Have you ever gone to one of the Reverend's services? She nods. What's it like? The services are cool. Very happy-clappy, if you know what I mean. But the music steals the show. It's like going to a concert or something. It makes the hour fly by. We can stay tonight if you want to, but I say we wait until Wednesday. Why? What happens on Wednesday? The Reverend puts on a buffet dinner after the services. Fried chicken, lasagna, mashed potatoes, more food than you've ever seen. And you should see those hoity-toity types tear into that buffet like they haven't eaten for days. They hover around the tables with their plates while the Reverend blesses the food, and his amen is like the shot of a starting pistol. They dive into that food like what are those people in the Bible with a famine? Canaanites? Yeah, them. Anyway, if we stay for this service and then help clean up afterward, we get to eat as much as we want, and the Reverend pays overtime. Overtime and a free meal. The two magic words. I nod, decision made. Let's wait till Wednesday, then. I look to Martina for confirmation, but she's looking over my shoulder. Her spine straightens, and her brows slam together. What the hell are you doing here? I turn to see a woman, no, a girl, coming down the aisle toward us. She's somewhere around 16 or 17, though she's helped along by her height, 6 feet and then some. Her skin is bronze, and her hair is natural, a wild crown of curly ringlets over high cheekbones and big green eyes. She's dressed like us, in the same khaki pants and God Works Here t-shirt, only hers are skin tight, her shirt knotted on the side to reveal a seductive slice of coppery skin. She moves closer, and I see she's biting back a smirk.
I work here. What are you doing here?
Martina shakes her head, and her hands tighten into fists.
You can't work here. I work here.
Well, I do. The girl says it short and matter-of-fact. Here I am.
Where's the Reverend?
Martina pushes past, almost mowing me over in her hurry into the opposite aisle.
I need to find the Reverend.
The girl rolls her eyes.
What are you going to tell him? That you stole my money?
At the accusation, Martina does an about-face, arms slinging in fury. I press myself to the chairs and get out of her way.
I already told you,
she shouts.
I didn't take your goddamn money. I didn't even know you had any until you accused me of taking it. And it's not like it was your cash to begin with. That hooker you stole it from probably just came back to claim what was hers.
They're making a lot of noise. Too much. I check behind us, scanning the rows of empty chairs. But as far as I can tell, there's nobody else here. Still, I wish they would stop yelling and cussing. The girl purses her lips.
That hooker did come back, and so did her pimp. Do you know what they do to people who take their money? You're lucky they didn't kill me.
What is that, some kind of threat? Because I didn't take your stupid money, and if you know what's good for you, you won't make me say it again.
Martina's accent is full-on south of the border now, all rolling R's and short staccato spurts. The girl lifts a brow.